Ranger Mike is here once again to lead us.
We're so thankful.
Thank you. All right, good evening, everybody. And we are about to go into our look at dinosaurs. And I should mention before I start this that this whole issue of dinosaurs was completely unknown. Nobody knew anything about dinosaurs. They hadn't even been discovered yet about 150 years ago, 160 years ago. Nobody had ever seen one. The term wasn't even invented yet. And so somebody found a tooth in England, and they took this tooth to an expert, and the expert looked at it and said, you know, if I didn't know better, I would say this is an iguana tooth. But we know the size of an iguana. We know that an iguana is a creature about that size. And so therefore, you can kind of see how big the teeth would be of a creature this size. And they get bigger than this. But this tooth was way too big. And they said, where did you find this? And so they said, they told where they'd found it. So they went back to the area to find out more about the creature. They found more bones, more teeth. And next thing they know, they realize they had a creature that was a very large iguana-like creature. And so they said, man, this would have been like crocodile size, you know, iguana. And it became the first of the dinosaurs discovered, whereas the first of the supposed dinosaur era creatures discovered. And it became known as Iguanodon. And then more and more of these things were found. And then the rest was history, because as more and more bones were found, sometimes just one single bone, they'd realize, wow, this thing is from a big creature. And so they discovered that out in certain states, specifically eastern Montana, down into Wyoming, down into Colorado, Utah, there are seams of these, like fissures in the rock or faults. There are seams that go up through that are full of these bones. And they began to send, rich men began to send teams of people out there and to see if they could outdo the other people. Carnegie was one, and if you go to his museum in Pittsburgh, his museum is one of the only ones that have the actual bones. When you go to a natural history museum or a dinosaur museum, you're not seeing the real bones. Almost all of them are museum, professional museum copies. And so in Carnegie's museum, they've got the real ones, and so you can actually go and see that. But these teams began to try to outdo each other, and they began to find that some of these guys were very large. And so a man by the name of Richard Owen, a Christian, a scientist, they began to realize, man, some of these things, they look like reptiles. They have the skeleton shape of a reptile, and these have to be very large reptiles, but some of them are big, like 80 feet long. And they could only just imagine, when these guys were alive, can you imagine one of these guys come walking down your street in your town? And they called all of them generically, they called them all terrible lizards. Well, scientists don't name creatures in English, they name them in Latin. So in Latin, that is dinosaurus. That's where we got the word dinosaur from. And so more and more of these things were discovered. Well, it just so happened that around the same time, a man in England was being stiff-armed or whatever into publishing a book that he was a little reluctant to do because he just knew it would change things. This was Charles Darwin, and he was about to write his book. And so his book came out, and almost to his big shock, he saw how hugely it was successful, and he realized the implications of pulling people away from God's word. And So his book that supposedly talked about, you know, eons of time and slow evolution and all that was being discovered by people at the same time the whole dinosaur issue was being discovered. And so so the two issues grew up together. So now when you hear the word dinosaur, you automatically think millions or, you know, at least millions of years ago. And that's what the general public has been pre-tuned to accept. Now, if you even suggest that a man, a human being, ever saw a dinosaur, you're laughed out of the room. To them, that is un, unquestionable nonsense. You can't possibly have a human being that's ever seen a dinosaur, because they will insist that dinosaurs disappeared some 65 million years ago. And they disagreed for a while about how it happened, but they finally, the scientists around the world finally agreed to agree that it was an asteroid hitting the planet. In other words, they don't know that's what it was. They just all decided to get together and say, we'll just say that's what it was. They don't know that. In fact, we know that that is not true, because that is not what brought about the demise of the dinosaurs. But that's what they said. An asteroid hit the planet 65 million years ago, and it wiped out the dinosaur species, and that kind of, you know, evolution had to kind of start all over again in a different vein. Well, since mankind has only been evolving from an ape-like creature for the last 2 to 4 million years, stands to reason that no man has ever seen a dinosaur. Well, we beg to differ. The Bible begs to differ and says the exact opposite. But that's how the whole dinosaur issue became a reality in our nation. So now we're born into it. All of us have been born into the whole idea of dinosaurs being a reality. But 150 years ago, it wasn't. That's relatively recently. Nobody had ever heard of one. Now today, it's interesting too, because they're in the Christian realms. There are still Christians who will say, dinosaurs weren't real, right? There are many who will say, aren't they just a fabrication of the evolutionists to try to convince us of evolution? There are still people who think that there were no such thing as dinosaurs. So I have to tell them, well, no, of course there were. Of course there were dinosaurs. And then try to show them, you know, how they fit into scriptures. So the other, another group, one guy said to me, and he should have known better. I don't know where he came up with saying this. He says, weren't the dinosaurs a creation of the devil? And I said to him, that's incredible that you would even ask that. I said, number one, where did you ever get the idea that the devil could create anything? The devil can't create anything. All he can do is destroy. He cannot create anything. And so, but that whole idea gives sort of weight to the idea that somehow the dinosaurs were evil. The dinosaurs created by the devil, so the dinosaurs are evil. No, the dinosaurs were not evil. They were just reptile-like creatures, or they were reptiles, but a certain type of reptile that that's just now extinct, just like there are many animals that are extinct. So what we want to do today is have a look at the issue from a biblical perspective. So we call it the mystery of the dinosaurs only because there are so many people who don't know how to answer the questions. And a lot of people don't buy into the evolution idea, but they will still think that dinosaurs somehow died millions of years ago. And so we want to look at that today. We want to look at what were they, and when did they really live, and what really happened to them. And then we're going to look at this from a biblical perspective. So now what I want to do is start off by showing you some teeth. I usually actually have the teeth with me, but again, since I'm flying, there's a sort of limited in weight. But this tooth is about that long, and I have it at home. This tooth is not from a dinosaur. It's from a whale, and this is from a sperm whale. So you might be saying, oh, that's interesting. Why are you showing us a picture of a sperm whale when we're talking about dinosaurs? Bear with me. Sperm whale tooth. How about this one? This tooth, and I have this one as well, it's a large molar. And I usually try to tell people I had a toothache about 3 months ago and they pulled this thing out of me, you know. And anyway, for some reason people don't buy it because it's a big molar. It's about the size of my fist. Anyway, I tell people too, this comes from the most dangerous creature in Africa. It's not a dinosaur tooth, but it's from the most dangerous creature in Africa. And a lot of people think, well, that's a lion or a crocodile. No, the most dangerous creature in Africa is that one. More people die from hippos than any other creature. And when my wife and I were missionaries in South Africa, we were crossing Lake St. Lucia on jet boats. There were two jet boats, and hippos, when they're in the water like this, hippos do not float, nor do hippos swim. They can't do either. So they're always, when you see hippos, they're always standing on the bottom. And if the water's over their head, they'll run along the bottom to the point where it's more shallow. But they can't swim and they don't float. But these guys are all sitting, and this was on that day. So we're going across with this jet boat, and this big hippo and the other at the back didn't want us there, and he was threatening, and literally he came over and he had came underneath the other boat and bit right through the hull. Fortunately, it was a double-hulled boat, and they were able to get the boat back to the land and get the people out, and then they pulled the boat out and could see the water draining out of the holds. In any event, you don't want to mess with a hippo because they get extremely dangerous at certain times of the year. Now, Now, that's the reality of the danger of a hippo. But let me just, you know, flip the coin while we're talking about that, and you'll see why a little bit later. But let me just tell you something else about a hippo. Hippos are also very funny. They do something very, very humorous that a lot of people find incredibly funny, and I do too. So hippos mark their territory a little bit like dogs do. But dogs use fire hydrants and telephone poles. You thought that fire hydrants were for water and telephone poles were telephones? No. They put them in your area for the dogs. That's what they're there for. In any event, a hippo, when it marks his territory, doesn't go around, you know, kind of doing number one on here and there. He goes around doing number two. But he doesn't just kind of plop, plop, put a meadow muffin there and plop, plop, another little meadow muffin over there. That's not what a hippo does. What he does is he's got this funny little tail that hangs down the back. When he's got it, has like a little brush on it. And when he's got to go, when that stuff comes out, he starts spinning his tail around back and forth, and it sprays that stuff everywhere. It looks like a manure spreader. It is very funny to watch. And so you don't want to be around a hippo that's marking his territory, okay? So I was telling that story in a church one time, and a lady, she puts up her hand like this, and I knew she had something to say. So she stood up and said, "I know that's true." She said, "Last year, my husband and I were at a zoo outside of Chicago, and we were at the hippo pen, and the hippo was only about 6 feet away from me. There's a fence there, of course. Hippo's standing right there. And she was watching this hippo, and she's looking at his tail, and she says to her husband, dear, come back and look at this hippo here. He's spinning his tail around." She goes, "The next thing I knew, I had hippo poop all over me, you know, and so..." So you want to be around a hippo that's marking his territory. It might be a little bit embarrassing and smelly for you for a little bit. But anyway, that's a hippo. How about this one? Here's another tooth. Looks like it could be a raptor tooth, but it's not. It's from a creature only its mother could love. But it still has a big, you know, sharp tooth. Or how about this one here? Now, this one is a dinosaur tooth, and I imagine you could guess which one it's from. It's probably from arguably the most famous of all the dinosaurs. And everybody knows this guy. It's the T-Rex. Now, interestingly, when you look at the T-Rex, I mean, everybody knows about a T-Rex, right? Everybody knows that T-Rex are these, you know, horrible, huge creatures that go, rah, and they come out of the jungle and grab lawyers out of outhouses and crunch them down. I mean, we know that because that's what the movies tell us, okay? And in fact, the Jurassic Park movies, the very first ones, I haven't seen any of the new ones at all, but the original Jurassic Park movies, anytime Hollywood gets involved in anything, it just seems like everything gets very, very distorted. But they have done a good job of coming alongside of the evolution community, bolstering the whole evolution idea. And so they, in those movies, if you remember, there's these guys, and it's always at nighttime when things are scarier, you know. They're sitting in a car, and there's a cup of coffee or water or something on the dashboard. And then while they're sitting there at night, they hear this, boom, boom. And of course, these guys are looking, they hear this sound coming up. It's this T-Rex coming up, and the camera zooms in on this coffee cup, and you can see the water jiggling like this each time you hear this, boom, boom, because he's shaking the earth. Now, folks, that's all Hollywood. I've been trapped in stampeding herds of elephants. Every single elephant is the size of a T-Rex, and they don't shake the earth like that. So Hollywood, again, has done a good job of trying to support the evolution idea of these guys. So T-Rex, though, a lot of people have looked at their T-Rex teeth, and they've said, you know, I don't really know that these guys were a fierce hunter, because about half of the tooth that you see there sticks out of the gum, I mean, and then the other half is in the gum. And a lot of them have looked at the root, and they've said, that does not look like a root of a creature that would go and attack a thick-skinned brachiosaur. Because if it is, the teeth would have gotten loose and just come right out. And so that's causing some scientists to rethink that maybe these things weren't these big, fierce hunters that we've been told they are. Maybe they were just scavengers. Now, we know that all creatures at the beginning ate what? They all ate green plants. So it's not a threat to the creation position at all that these guys ate plants at one time. All creatures did. The Bible, you know, says that we even ate plants too. We were given permission to eat meat later on. And of course, creatures like lions began to eat meat later. But at the beginning, the food for all creatures was green plants. So when evolutionists have looked at the T-Rex teeth and they've said, man, look at that. Long, sharp tooth. Obviously, always a meat eater. Really? Long, sharp tooth, obviously always a meat eater. Long, sharp tooth, obviously always a meat eater. Not necessarily. There you have the whale tooth, there you have the warthog tooth. Just because a creature has long, sharp teeth doesn't prove anything. It only proves that it had long, sharp teeth. There are some reptiles today that have long, sharp teeth that do not eat meat. It's not an issue if they did. It's not a threat to us. But it is just something that has caused a lot of scientists to start questioning, were these guys always the big, fierce creatures that go around ripping up other creatures that they're supposed to... that they're supposed to have been. And when you look at a T-Rex and you look at his rows of teeth, that part of him looks very fierce. What about the rest of him? What about his huge, long front legs? You know, if he doesn't, you know, threaten you with his big teeth, what is he going to do? Hey, come here. I'm going to rip you apart with my big, long, front. You know, so it's almost a comical creature when you think about it. Looks almost like a reptile version of a kangaroo. In fact, when you look at a kangaroo and then look at the bones of a T-Rex, they almost look like the same creature, different mouth, you know. But anyway, so it's kind of a funny creature. They don't really know how fast they were or really what their diet was. So even their whole foundation is being shaken even by themselves. But what we want to do is look at some characteristics of reptiles, because they're considered to be reptiles, and so we want to look at the characteristics. What is one characteristic of a reptile? The first one would be they come out of an egg. Now, that's not true of all reptiles. There are some reptiles that are born live. In other words, there are a number of snakes that are born live, but most reptiles come out of an egg. Now, the eggs are typically soft and leather-like, whereas bird eggs tend to be hard and brittle, and you can crack them. Whereas the reptile eggs that I had from all the reptiles I used to have in South Africa, the eggs were a little softer and more leather-like. But anyway, so dinosaurs came out of eggs too. I have no idea if a T-Rex came out of an egg this size. The largest egg ever found was about 18 inches long. That's a fossilized egg. That's a pretty big egg, a long, thin egg. But most dinosaur eggs are relatively small. In fact, a crocodile comes out of an egg about the size of a goose, but then it can grow to about 20, 23 feet, and they can be quite large. I used to work occasionally in South Africa with a man by the name of Tony Pooley. He was a ranger in our area, and he worked for our provincial parks, what you would call a state park over here. And he was considered the world's leading authority on crocodiles. And so occasionally I'd go down. He was an evolutionist, but we got along real well. And I would go help him catch fish in this lake for his crocodile farm, because he had this croc farm. He'd do studies of them. One of those crocs was 23 feet long. And when he would call it, they would call it by hitting on this piece of wood that they had, hitting on this fence material they had, and it would make a loud sort of sound, and this was almost the dinner bell for the crocodiles. So the crocodiles would come, and you'd see this small one here, like a little six-footer, maybe another small one, a nine-footer. When the big one would come, you'd see the reeds parting, and this huge thing would come out, and that's as close as we could imagine to a dinosaur. Because this huge 23-footer would come out and just walking up to the fence like this. A 23-foot reptile is a monster. And so anyway, that's something that you don't kind of forget that. But in any event, so they come out of eggs, and then they grow to whatever size they did. We have no idea how big a T-Rex egg was. We have no idea about how big a Brachiosaur egg was. That's just one characteristic that they have. Another characteristic is that they have scales on their skin. What is a scale? A scale is a fold of the skin. And if you look at these, you'll see different types of scales. Chameleons, for example, they have scales that can actually turn color. And it's interesting how there's layers that make up right below the skin that can actually influence the color changing, and then it shows right through the scales. Some don't change color, but there are many that can. And there's all kinds. There's very heavy, almost armor plate ones, to the ones that almost look like feathers down here in the lower left corner. And that is one of the issues today that I want to bring up. The evolutionists must explain where birds came from. On their tree of life, we have all the living creatures that we have today, but whatever those creatures are, in order for them to even imagine that their theory is correct, they have to imagine where everything came from. So when you get to the birds, that is a big anomaly to them. Where did birds come from? Well, they have all satisfied themselves because of two things, that birds came from dinosaurs or at least an early form of reptile. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, there are some reptile bones, some dinosaur bones, that have somewhat of a similar look to certain bird bones. Second, they will look at scales like this, like in that lower left-hand picture there. They will look at that and say, over the eons, the scales turned into feathers. And they will claim that. And the gullible public will look at that and say, oh, okay, yeah, it kind of looks like feathers as it is. So maybe they just grew out into feathers. No. Let me explain something. A feather is a very unique part of a bird. A feather does not have anything to do with the skin. It grows through it, but it's not part of the skin. Feathers are amazing, and they're very different from a scale. Most birds have five different kinds of feathers. They have covering feathers, they have insulating feathers, they have display feathers, or like in the case of this one on the right side of the screen, that's a flight feather. They're asymmetrical. And when you put a whole bunch of asymmetrical feathers on the back of a bird wing, they are literally shaped like an airplane wing. And so when the creature creates forward lift like that, it can literally lift the bird up off the ground because they're extremely light and very, very strong. And if you look at how a feather is put together, there's one main shaft that goes the whole way from one end to the other. Off of that main shaft are almost very small feathers that come off the side. And those are called barbs, the side feathers, because they themselves have barbs that go off. It's like an ongoing little tree that keeps getting smaller and smaller to the point where at the end of the barbules, there are little tiny hooks. So when a bird preens itself and pulls on its feathers like that, it's lining up all those hooks again, and they keep everything lined like that to keep the feather strong, keep it clean, and keep it healthy. And so a feather is a very incredible part of a bird. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the scale. They're made even out of different material. In order for an evolutionist to try to show you that a scale turned into a feather, if you were here last night, you would understand the whole idea of the coding that goes inside each cell. You would have to show how mutations literally took information to code for a fold of skin, which is what a scale is, to turn it somehow into a feather that doesn't have anything to do with the skin anymore. It grows through it, but it's not even closely related at all. But visually, you can see why many people get duped, because they will say, oh yeah, the scales, if given them the miracle of millions of years, somehow we can hide what happened behind millions of years, because we can't observe it happening. We cannot see how a scale could turn into a feather. There's nothing demonstrated that can show how it happens. So the mystery of it is always hidden behind millions of years. And that's always the way it is with it. The other aspect is the bones. Some bones of birds, as you know, are hollow because birds need to be light and they have to be able to fly like that, and the lighter they are, the better. Well, they've noticed that some bones, not only of certain reptiles, certain dinosaurs have hollow bones, and some of them have a similar shape. So many of them say, oh yeah, I can see how a bird, you know, came from a dinosaur. And those are the only two links. Similar bones here and there, and scales that supposedly turn into feathers. That's all they have, but that's what they go on. What they conveniently don't tell you about is how different reptile lungs are than bird lungs. Bird lungs, when a bird breathes, when you go through the cycle of breathing, you're taking oxygen in and expelling it, like a reptile will do. A bird, when a bird breathes, every time it breathes in and breathes out, it's always literally exchanging gases. In other words, their whole system is designed so that breathing in and out, it is always, the air does not go in and back out. It's always being pumped through the system. When a bird breathes, it's actually filling other sacs. And so when it exhales, these sacs are collapsing and forcing oxygen into the cells that it needs it. So the bird is always taking in oxygen as opposed to the way you and I would breathe. We take in oxygen, then we expel it. We take in oxygen, then expel it. A bird is always essentially taking in oxygen. It's a very unique system, and it has to be that way so they can get the energy out to where they need it right now to fly. And they conveniently don't tell you how in the world a reptile lung changes into a bird lung. Another thing they conveniently don't tell you is how a cold-blooded creature turns into a warm-blooded creature. We'll look at that in a moment. Because of how I learned about cold-blooded. But anyway, so that's just the whole idea of the scales turning into feathers. Another interesting aspect of reptiles is that all reptiles today that we see, large and small, all of them crawl on their bellies. So when you look at a reptile like this one today, and this is just a average-sized lizard like we used to have on our mission station, if you look at the anatomy of it, it crawls on its stomach. They have a skeletal structure such that at the legs stick out of the side of their bodies. All reptiles are the same way. Now, they can sometimes push up, and some of them, when they run, they can push up and run, but still, the skeletal structure is such that the legs come out of the side of the bodies. That's actually not what a dinosaur was. A dinosaur was a reptile that had a skeletal structure such that the legs stuck out of the bottom of the bodies, like a cow, a dog, or an elephant. But as you can see, this is what it looks like. The legs stick out of the bottom like an elephant as opposed to sticking out of the side. That is actually one of the main differences between dinosaurs that are no longer with us and reptiles that are. In fact, if you go to the Smithsonian Institute right on the wall in the dinosaur room, they will tell you what the definition of a dinosaur is. It's basically three things. Dinosaurs are reptiles that live on dry land, that have a skeletal structure such that the legs come out of the bottom of the body. That's essentially what the definition of a dinosaur is. So we don't see any of the reptiles today, large or small, with legs that come out of the bottom. But we do have a lot of these, large and small, with legs that come out the side. I submit to you that that might be part of why these guys went extinct. And we'll look at that in a few minutes. So the whole idea is they have legs that stick out of the bottom. Here's another aspect which I never knew, I never realized until it was kind of too late for, probably anyway, for some of my reptiles. This type of lizard, this is called a blue-headed lizard. It's this lizard right here. This one is painted green. They aren't green. They're gray like that. So the one on the right, you can see its head is beginning to turn blue. These are called blue-headed lizards, blue-headed tree agamas specifically. And they would sit on the tree like this. This is a fairly young one, but the older ones can get longer than that. And they would sit on the trees on our mission station. When I would see them, I couldn't just let them there, you know, because I had to go and catch one, you know. And so if I saw them sitting on a tree, if I would walk up to it to try to catch it off the tree, they'd see me coming a mile away, and they'd run up the tree, and they'd be gone. So I developed a way, when I would see one sitting on the tree, I developed a way of kind of marking in my mind exactly where it was, and then walking way around the tree and coming up from behind real quietly. And I would remember in my mind more or less where the lizard was, and I'd sneak up from behind and go and put my hand right back right on it. Now, can you picture what happens to the lizard at that point? It basically panics, okay, you can imagine. So I pull it off the tree, and now this guy is hissing like mad. And he's, you know, and he's scratching up the back of my hand, and his tail's flicking around, and they have very, very dangerous teeth. And he'd be hissing. These guys can hiss very loudly. So he'd be going, ah, and like, ooh, what do you do with a little dragon like this, you know? If I put him on the ground, he'll turn around and jump at you, and you don't want to get bitten by these guys. They've got razor-sharp teeth. They'll make mincemeat out of you real quickly. So I did the only thing I could think to do. I'd take him to my bedroom and put him under my pillow. Well, what else do you do with it? Okay, so then at the end of the day, I'd come back, and I'd lift up my pillow, and there's my lizard sitting real calmly on my bed, and I'd real gently reach down and pick him up. Now he's not so feisty anymore, and I'd pick him up, and I'd hold him like this, and I'd pat him slowly, and sometimes he'd close his eyes, you know, and I thought I was a genius. I thought I had figured out a real quick way to tame a reptile, and so I thought, oh, okay, buddy, see, it's okay, you know, I'm your friend. So I would go take them and put them on my curtain or wherever they were. And if I'd come into my room and see one of my lizards somewhere, I would go out to the bottles I kept outside, because for some reason my mom did not want me having my snakes in the house. Two of my snakes were cobras. And so, you know, I mean, I don't know why she wouldn't want those in the house. But anyway, for some reason she didn't. So I had all my chameleons and snakes and stuff outside, and I had a big bottle of bugs that I used to keep and to feed them. So I'd go and grab a bug out, and I'd walk up and see this lizard there, and I'd tap him on his mouth, and he'd go, ah, and I'd shove the bug in, and he'd chomp away. One day, my mom called me, and I could tell she was not real happy. And I said, yeah, yes, Mom. She goes, look in there. So she pointed into my mom and dad's, on my mom and dad's bed, and right on my mom's pillow sat one of these guys fast asleep. And I said, oh, no. And she goes, that's right, oh, no. You know the rule. If you can't keep them in your room, you can't have them in the house. So she made me get rid of all 28 of them I had living in my bedroom at the time. So cruel, Mom, you know. So I went and I sadly, you know, went around and got all my lizards, and you can actually see me there. That's my hand as a 9 or 10 year old. You can see one of my lizards there. In fact, they weren't all big like that. Some of them were little like that one. But anyway, so I took my lizards and I put them out on the trees like this, and I'd put my hand there and, you know, say, come on, buddy, hold on there and hold on there. And you know, it's funny because the males, they're all just gray like this. But before I would catch them, if there was a male, the heads would turn beautiful blue, and they'd have like green and yellow that go down the back, and they're beautiful. And the males would bounce their heads like this, you know, they bounce their heads, you know, while they're sitting there. I used to think that was a, you know, a lizard imitating a leaf blowing to stay camouflaged. When I asked the rangers about it, they said, oh, no, that's a male trying to attract a female. I said, oh, I didn't know that, you know. So when I came over here and went to college, I walked up to the girls and went, hi. Didn't work for me. They just thought I was an idiot. So anyway, by the time I let my lizards go, none of them had blue heads at all anymore. They were all just boring, dull gray, And I noticed my lizards, some of them were so tame they could hardly even hold on to the trees. And I began to realize, you know what? My lizards don't seem tame. They seem sick. But you know what? They weren't even sick. Do you know what they were? They were cold. I did not realize what cold-blooded meant. I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a cold-blooded. I was only a kid. I hadn't even learned what that meant yet. And here, once I learned what that meant, man, I was slowly killing my reptiles, killing my lizards. They do not get food, they do not get warmth from the food they eat. That's the difference between cold-blooded and warm-blooded. You and I and the mammals and birds are warm-blooded. What does that mean? It means when we eat food, most of it burns in our body. It's called metabolizing. It burns in our body to make sure our body stay at an exact temperature. If it goes up by a degree or down by a degree, we feel sick. So all warm-blooded creatures, most of the food that we eat goes to keeping our bodies warm, and a little bit of it goes to feed the cells in our bodies. Not so a reptile. They don't get any warmth by the food they eat. So when they eat food, all of what they eat goes to feeding their cells. So reptiles don't need to eat that often. In fact, some snakes that you might buy in a pet store, they might only need to eat maybe twice a year. And so, because none of what they eat goes to keeping their bodies warm, it only goes to feeding their cells. Well, I didn't know that. And so, how do they get warm, though? They have to sit in the sun. Or if you buy a reptile in a pet shop, you have to buy a heat lamp to keep it warm, because that's the only way they have of warming up their body so that they can be active and actually catch a creature and actually digest it. I was feeding my creature, my lizards, far more than they needed, and also I was probably slowly killing them because they probably couldn't digest their food properly. And so here they were getting colder and colder and colder. Here I was thinking I was taming them. They weren't. They could hardly move. By the time I let them go finally, and by the time the sun warmed them back up, they were just as feisty as the day I first caught them. But that's how I discovered the difference between cold-blooded and warm-blooded. So that's another question for the evolutionists. How then did a reptile that's cold-blooded turn into a warm-blooded creature, a bird? Do you know their way of answering that question? Well, dinosaurs probably were warm-blooded after all. Isn't that convenient? So it's a very convenient way for them to try to skirt something. There's no proof of that. If they were reptiles, they were cold-blooded. How do you turn one into the other? There isn't an answer to that. So one other interesting issue about reptiles is that they never stop growing as long as they're alive. So this guy, he's a young lizard, but if he could stay alive a long time, he'd get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Usually, the only thing that brings a reptile to its end is getting eaten by an eagle or something like that, getting eaten by something else, or getting caught by a bigger reptile, whatever. But they continually grow as long as they're alive. That brings up a very interesting idea about these guys. And it's just a question. There's no fact here. I'm just curious if this might be a possibility. So prior to the flood, mankind could live almost 1,000 years. We had the genetic ability to live almost 1,000 years. So if we have the ability to do that, could the animals have had that? Maybe. They might have been able to live a long time too. We don't know that at all. I'm just surmising. And if you're the type of creature that never stops growing as long as you're alive, you might wind up to be pretty considerable in size by the time you die at maybe 1,000 years old. So when you find a dinosaur that is maybe 100 feet long, it might have been one designed originally to be 80 feet long. And maybe it's just a very old dinosaur. And it could be the same creature. They'll now just give it a new name. They'll say, oh, this dinosaur was 100 feet long, and give it a new name. It might not be a different creature. It just could be an old one that maybe had grown to be 100 feet or so. It's just a thought. It's just an amazing thing to kind of think about how these guys could, if they continually keep growing, if they could live a long time, they could get quite big. So now what we've just looked at a few interesting characteristics of reptiles. So now we want to switch over and talk about the issue of how they relate to scriptures. And there are always at least three questions that I've had over the years about dinosaurs and the Bible. Number one, when did they really live? Does the Bible, is that even something that's mentioned? When did they live? What actually happened to them? And why doesn't the Bible talk about them? So let's have a look at that from a unique perspective. I'm going to draw a timeline on the screen. And I'm going to say that the left end of the timeline is at creation, and the right end is where we live today. Now, in your Bible, there are at least 6 genealogies. What is a genealogy? A genealogy is a list of names that was very important to the Hebrew people. In other words, this person had a son, he had a son, he had a son. They loved these lines of people, so they could trace, the Jews loved to trace their lineage the whole way back to Abraham, and Abraham the whole way back to Noah, and then, of course, Noah the whole way back to Adam. And it was very important to their culture. Well, the Bible is a book about Jesus Christ, so the genealogies in this book are essentially about Jesus' lineage. And there are at least 6 genealogies in here. And some of them actually give you years associated with a particular person. For example, it will say that Adam, the first man, lived 130 years before his son Seth was born. And the Bible says he had many other sons and daughters, but the reason why Seth is pulled out is because Seth became the ancestor of Jesus. Seth was so many years old before his son was born that became in the line to Jesus. He was so many years old before his son was born, and so forth. And you can add up all these years from creation the whole way down to the flood. You can add them up for yourself. It totals about 1,656 years from creation to the flood. And then you could add up the years from the flood down to Abraham, from Abraham down to Moses, Moses eventually down to King David, and then King David all throughout the monarchs that reigned in Judah. And then when that all came to an end, then there's 400 years of silence between the Old and the New Testament, and then Jesus was born roughly 2,000 years ago. If you add up all those years together, you have roughly 6,000 to 7,000 years. If you add it up directly the way it appears in the Bible, it looks more like 6,000 years, even though it could be between 6,000 and 7,000. What I'm going to do is just choose 6,000 because it won't change the graph that much. So let's just say that this represents 6,000 years, not millions and billions. So you add up those years together, you wind up with roughly 6,000. So let's just say this is 6,000 years, and I'm going to divide it into equal 1,000-year periods. So I'm going to put a line at every 1,000 years, and we're going to try to answer those questions right now. The first question we need to answer, and it's going to be a little like putting a puzzle together. When you put a puzzle together, the first thing you do is you turn over all the pieces to make sure you know what you have. Then you try to find the corner pieces and the edge pieces, and you kind of build it from there. If you build the whole puzzle and you discover that three or four of the pieces are missing, can you still see the picture in general, what it is? Of course you can. You might not know what was missing right here where this puzzle piece is missing, and you might not know some of those things. And that's a little bit with the dinosaur era. There are some things we can't know because they're not alive now. Like one of the things is, what did they eat? All you can kind of do is guess a little bit by their teeth what they might have wound up eating, but we don't know that for sure. It's a puzzle piece that's missing. Another piece that's missing is what specifically happened to them. But that, I'm going to get ahead of myself there. So here's the question we need to ask first. First question is, when did God make them? Because if the question that's being asked is, when did they actually live? We turn that around to another question. We say, when did God make them? Because the Bible makes it clear that everything was made by God. In fact, the book of John, he says, without Jesus making things, nothing was made that was made. He made everything, and if you were here this morning, you realize he made everything in a literal six-day period. So then you'd have to say, okay, there's a corner piece of the puzzle. The dinosaurs were made at the beginning in those 6 days of creation. On which day would that have been? Because somebody might look at their Bible and say, well, I don't see that word dinosaur on the days of creation. No, you wouldn't see that word dinosaur because it's a Latin word and the Old Testament was written in Hebrew. But furthermore, you're not going to see zebra and giraffe in here anyway, either. He simply says, on day number 5, he made the creatures of the sea and the creatures of the air. On day number 6, he made the creatures that creep along the ground, the beasts of the earth and the beasts of the field. Those are the land-dwelling creatures. What is a dinosaur by definition? A land-dwelling reptile. There's another corner piece of the puzzle. They were made on day number 6. Who else was made on day number 6? Mankind. They were made together. God even said that to Job. He said, go and look at Behemoth, which I made along with you. They were made on the same day. And then they lived together for 1,656 years. That's the time frame in blue. That is when you might say the age of dinosaurs. At least that's when they might have been maybe more prevalent than any time afterwards. That's the period that they might have lived the most. Now, and also during that period, the dinosaurs never ruled anything. That job was given to mankind to do. When you hear the evolutionists talking about the age when dinosaurs ruled. Dinosaurs never ruled anything. That job was always given to mankind to do. So the dinosaurs lived with man for 1,656 years. They became extinct at that point. In fact, all creatures that breathe air through nostrils, that walk on dry land, became extinct at that time too. Except the creatures that were where? On the ark, exactly. And by the way, before we move on to talk about the ark, I just want to mention one thing. Somebody years ago had asked me a question that nobody has asked ever since, and maybe that person knew what a lot of people know. Now, is in the fossil record, it is very rare to find a bird. It is very rare to find a mammal. In the fossil record, what you mostly find are sea creatures, and then you find reptiles. You find a lot of reptiles, a lot of dinosaur bones, and so forth. So that is another reason why the evolutionists love to look at that and say, oh yeah, that's another vestige of the past, of the eons of the past. No, it could be simply a matter of mathematics. Here's what I mean by that. In the case of birds, they have hollow bones, so that when during that fossilization process, when the creatures are being buried, a creature with hollow bones and a very lightweight feathers with lots of hollow things in them are going to float much easier, and they're going to escape the fossilization process. So you're not going to find too many fossilized birds. Most of them just would have just rotted away because they would have floated to the surface. And by the way, let me answer this question too. I get this question a lot. Why are there or are there any human fossil bones? There are, and every time they are found, the evolutionists absolutely have a cow over that, because you can't have human fossils in the ground with the dinosaurs. That's absolutely impossible because they didn't live together. They couldn't have. And so human bones down there are not going to be able to be, you know, that's not possible. So the question is, are there any human fossils? And the answer is yes, there are. And every time they are found, like I mentioned, the evolutionists have a cow over that, but they always wind up saying those bones were buried intrusively by a creationist. So, of course, we're going to go dig way down and we're going to make sure all the layers are properly packed again, you know, above it. And anyway, they just can't have it, the fact that the mankind might have lived with the dinosaurs. So that's one thing. The other reason probably why humans did not fossilize, at least not very many of them, is because we of all creatures would know the property of water. We would know that water would find its lowest place, even though we're being very confused by everything that's going on, you know, the fountains of the deep exploding out and all the floodwaters. We would know to get high. We would know to go up. The other animals are going to run around like a deer in the headlight, and they're not going to know what to do, and they're going to wind up getting buried. Humans would know to go up to escape, and as they would be drowning by the water, their bodies would decompose very, very quickly. And any creatures going up with us probably became food for the people. And I could imagine, and maybe you can too, that some people, because there were millions and billions of trees that were ripped up. So it was probably floating islands of trees where people could actually live for a while, maybe. Maybe they would lash some of these trees together. And any animals that were on there with them probably became food for those people. Again, the Bible is silent on this. I'm just trying to imagine what could have happened here, what it would be like to have maybe initially survived the blasts or whatever that were happening to start the flood. But eventually you're going to run out of food, and eventually you're going to run out of fresh water, and you're going to die a terrible death just on these little islands of trees like that. But at least we humans would know to go up to escape the water. So we would not wind up being fossilized. We'd just rot away. That's why very few bones are found of people. But why are there so many reptile bones? It could be simply this. When reptiles lay eggs, they always lay a whole clutch of eggs, sometimes dozens of eggs. Think about most mammals. Now, I'm not talking about cats and dogs and mice, okay? Most mammals have one baby. An elephant has one baby. A cow has one baby, okay? Most mammals have one baby. All reptiles have a whole host of babies. And at the beginning, when no creature was an enemy of any other creatures, which type of creature do you think was going to multiply quicker? The mammals are only producing one a year. The reptiles are producing many of them. So it could be that at the time of the flood, there were far more reptiles on the planet than there are now. I'm just surmising that that could be the case just through multiplication. So when somebody says, why do we find so many reptiles in the fossils and in the fossil record and very few mammals, it probably was simply that. There were probably a lot more of them on the earth at that time. So then somebody might say, okay, well, wait a minute. Were there dinosaurs on the ark then? I mean, were they on the ark? Yes, there were. How do we know that? We know that by four different means. Number one, dinosaurs were still alive at the time the flood started. How do we know that? Because we find their fossils in the sediments produced by the flood. And I could go on and talk about how that works out and how we find most dinosaur fossils, but literally, they are in the mud that is now rock that was formed during the flood. And so we know they were alive at the time the flood started. Number two, God told Noah to take two of every kind of animal with him on the ark. If the dinosaurs were still alive, are they a kind of animal? And I could ask a question, is a lion or the original form of that, is that a kind of animal? Sure. Is a giraffe or the original form of that, is that a kind of animal? Sure. Is a dog or the original form of that, was that a kind of animal? Sure. Is a brachiosaur or the original kind, the original form of that, was that a kind of animal? Sure it was. So yes, they were still alive. God said to him, take two of them with you on the ark. Thirdly, the Bible says that Noah obeyed God. If they were still alive and he told him to take two of every one of them on the ark, the Bible says Noah obeyed God. They were on the ark. And lastly, did Noah have to go out and find the animals? No, the Bible says that he brought the animals to Noah to put them all on the ark. Noah might not have even known of all the various creatures that were alive at the time. He just brought them to Noah, and Noah put them on the ark. So yes, there were dinosaurs on the ark. So then that brings up another question. Wait. How in the world is Noah going to fit a huge brachiosaur on the ark? I mean, come on, it's way too big to fit on the ark. Well, stop a minute. If I had been able to bring my model of the ark with me, you could see how huge this thing was. And the fact that each deck was 15 feet in height would have been very adequate for anything that was growing larger and also for air circulation and so forth. But when somebody says it's impossible, he couldn't have had all those big creatures on the ark, who said he took the big creatures on the ark? Does a brachiosaur start off large or does it start off small? It starts off small. So it is entirely possible that he could have taken younger creatures with him on the ark. And what advantage would that have had? Well, it would have had several advantages. Again, the Bible is silent. The Bible doesn't say this is what he did. It's just that when somebody says that's impossible, no, it isn't. And here is one way it might have happened. He might have taken young ones, and there would be advantages. For example, young animals would perhaps be healthier than the adults because maybe they haven't gotten into scraps of over territories or over a female or whatever. They might be healthier. Number two, young animals are smaller, so they don't take up as much room on board the ark. Number three, young animals don't eat as much as adults. And by the way, we're not told that Noah knew how long this was going to be. It was 375 days from beginning to end, from the time that the door closed to the time it opened and they came off. But we don't know that Noah knew that. He might have, but we don't know. So how did he know how much food to take on board the ark? So anyway, young animals don't eat as much, so there's not as much food that they have to worry about going through. And because young animals are smaller, there's not as much waste for the people to have to get rid of. So now, think about this. Picture if you were going to clean up after the animals each day, and you go to the wing of the ark where the elephants are and the big, you know, the rhinos and the giraffes and stuff. You're going to have to take a wheelbarrow with you, right? Because you have to go to the cages and open up the cage and go into the elephant pen and scoop up all his big meadow muffins, scoop them all up and put them in the wheelbarrow, go off to the giraffe pen, the same deal. What do you do when you get to the hippo pen? Because his poop is all over the ceiling, all over the walls and everything, because remember he did his little tail thing, you know? So he's kind of spread his poop everywhere, so you have to scrape down the walls in the hippo pen. Anyway, so they produce less waste for the people to have to get rid of. Young animals sleep a lot. So you don't have to worry about that. Also, a lot of creatures might have gone into hibernation, or reptiles might have gone into a brumative state, which is like hibernation. Because the ark might have been dark, sitting in the water like that. Who knows? They might have done a lot of sleeping. But young animals don't fight with each other. You can put a baby lion and a baby zebra together, and it's very cute. They'll play with each other. That changes when they get bigger, though. So here are some reasons why he might have taken younger ones and some advantages of having done that. But we don't know that for sure. But here's the next question that people ask. Okay, makes sense so far. They were on board the ark. Well, certainly God saw to it that they came off the ark safely, right? Yes, he did. So then the big question gets to be, well, what happened to them? How come we have all the other creatures today and we don't have the dinosaurs? Stop right there. It's a wrong question because it's based on a wrong assumption. We tend to think that the animals we live with on the planet is everything that there ever was. Uh-uh. If you talk with most zoologists, they will tell you most creatures have gone extinct since that time. We're living with a relatively few creatures now that used to be alive. So many of them have gone extinct since then. It's not just the dinosaurs. We're fascinated with the dinosaurs simply because of the size that some of them could have grown to. And that just fascinates us. But by the way, do you know that dinosaurs not only came in the large varieties like this, but many dinosaurs were very small, like little chickens. And you don't want to go to a museum and see a little chicken-sized dinosaur. You want to go and see the big dinosaurs. That's what has become famous. So we're intrigued by dinosaurs, by, well, what happened to them? Why did they go extinct? Well, we should be asking the question, why did the saber-toothed tiger go extinct? Why aren't we so fascinated with those things? We're fascinated with dinosaurs because of the size of them. But here are some possibilities. You might have heard some of them. You might have heard that, well, maybe after the flood, when the animals came off the ark, maybe there wasn't enough vegetation to keep this kind of creature alive, and so they just died out from lack of food. I don't buy that one either. How about this one? You might have heard that, well, maybe their lung structure was such that the atmosphere was very different. Maybe it wasn't as oxygen rich as it was before the flood, and maybe they couldn't breathe properly and they went extinct that way. I don't buy that either. In fact, folks, what I am fascinated with is the fact that this kind of creature with legs that come out of the bottom, large and small, are extinct. But this kind, with legs that come out of the side, large and small, are still with us. I think it could simply be a matter of predation. We don't know, for example, how fast a dinosaur was. They might have been slow lumbering type creatures. Even the T-Rex might have been a very slow creature. We don't know. But the point is, this kind of creature can do an escape, can escape very easily by running up a tree, or running and hiding under a rock, or hiding under a bush, or jumping into water and swimming. They have an anatomy that allows them to escape all kinds in all kinds of situations. These guys can't. This is not the kind of creature that can climb a tree. This is not the kind of creature that can hide under a rock. This is not the kind of creature that's designed to swim by jumping in the water and swimming away. It could be that animals and humans brought them to extinction just over time, just because they were maybe easy prey, or maybe these guys, as they were getting bigger, you imagine a herd of these guys coming into your field of corn? They could probably wipe out a whole field of corn real quickly. It could be that we wipe them out simply because they're eating up our crops. It could be as simple as that. The creatures with the legs that come out of the bottom couldn't escape as easy as these guys, and eventually they went extinct. By the way, when I say eventually, we sell a book, we don't have it with us, but we do on our website. It's called Dire Dragons, and it is a phenomenal book that documents different cultures around the world that have documented dinosaur-like creatures that lived with them in more modern times. When I'm talking about modern times, I'm talking about maybe 300-500 years ago. And so you're talking, if you look at the time frame here, the dinosaurs probably lived way into societies long after the flood, going extinct like many other creatures have gone extinct over time. And after a while, it's just sort of been lost to us as far as when they were last seen. But what actually happened to them? That's one of the puzzle pieces that's still missing. I suspect that they were easy prey just because they couldn't escape, and large or small, and eventually they just went extinct like many other creatures did. However, we do know that in Job's time, there were still some very interesting reptiles around. One of them could be classed as a dinosaur. We don't know when Job lived. Some people say he was a contemporary of Abraham. Other people say he lived much later. We don't really know, but we know that he lived long after the flood. And if you've ever read the book of Job, you know what happened to Job. He had some nasty problems associated with his life, and his friends were no help to him. And eventually, God comes to him. And when God comes to him, does God tell him why all of this happened? Uh-uh. God doesn't say, he doesn't say to Job, "Job, we're going to study theology. Take out your Bible and turn to 2 Hesitations 4:12. He doesn't say that. What does God do? He hits him with his creation. He asks Job question after question after question about creatures and things that God made. The expression of God, his creation on the planet. And he says, "Job, you answer me." And he asks him all these questions about creation, and Job can't. Finally, in chapter 40, he says something weird. He says, "Job, go and consider Behemoth, which I made along with you." Now, in my Bible and in yours, probably too, there's a little asterisk there because we don't know what behemoth means. And on the bottom of the page, it says this is probably a rhino, a hippo, or an elephant. So, okay, you think, all right, so it's a rhino or a hippo or an elephant. Okay, you read on in the chapter, and you're not in the chapter too long before he says he is chief among the creations of God. So some theologians think that means he's the largest creature that God made. He's the premier creature. He's the one with the most eminence there. Well, okay, you've got to be talking about the elephant then, because the elephant is the largest creature on the planet. So you can't be talking about a rhino or a hippo. They're much smaller than an elephant. So you read the description of this behemoth. Talks about his stomach muscles and the tubes of of bronze, like his bones are tubes of bronze or bars of steel, and just incredible power. It all sounds like an elephant. But then it says, he eats grass like an ox. Uh-oh, now I know he's not talking about an elephant anymore, because an ox eats only grass. An elephant is a browser, which means it eats mainly leaves and branches. It'll sometimes eat sweet grass, but its primary diet is leaves and branches. What is an ox's diet is only grass. So it eats grass like an ox. Now I know he's not talking about an elephant. Later on in the chapter, it gets strange. He says he sways his tail like a cedar tree. Now look at the elephant's tail. This is not a cedar tree. This is a glorified fly whisk. That's essentially what the elephant's tail is. If you would look at the trees in Job's time, the cedar trees in Job's time, large stately trees, and when the wind would blow, they would sway like this. That's, you know, an elephant's tail is not the kind of tail that sways like a cedar tree, but this is the kind of tail that sways like a cedar tree. And when you think about it, think about all the other descriptions that God is giving. If it's the largest creature that God made, and that's what a lot of theologians think it is, we've never found in the fossil record a creature like a Diplodocus or a Brachiosaur. We've never found anything larger. He eats grass like an ox. He sways his tail like a cedar tree. And Job could still go and see them still alive. So they had obviously survived the flood. They were obviously living in Job's time. Then God says something very strange to Job, as if that wasn't strange enough. He said, go and consider Leviathan. This is in chapter 41. Leviathan. So in your Bible and in mine, there's a little asterisk that says a Leviathan is probably a crocodile. Now remember something about footnotes. Footnotes are there to help you understand a passage, but they are not the inspired word of God. They're there to help you, but in some cases they're wrong. In this case, it's wrong. It says this is probably a crocodile. Well, if you read the description of a Leviathan, it certainly starts off sounding like a crocodile. God describes the creature living in the water. When he swims, he froths up the water. When he comes out on land, he leaves his track on the land. Can you make an agreement with him? Can you tame him as you can a pet? Well, all of that certainly sounds like a crocodile. You can't do that with a croc. And then it says, look at the scales of his body, all tightly woven together. Look at his rows of fierce teeth. Boy, that all sounds like a crocodile. But then God says, you cannot kill him with the sword, the javelin, the dart, the spear. He lists all the weapons of the day. Now I know he's not talking about a crocodile, because you can kill a croc with any of them. But you couldn't kill this Leviathan with it. And furthermore, at the end of the chapter, he says, his snorting, whatever that means, whatever that word in Hebrew, it translates in English into a snorting. So a sound that, some sort of a sound he makes. His snorting produces fire out of his mouth. Now, wait a minute. Now we know we're talking about fairy tales, right? That's what the evolutionists would say. They would say, okay, now we know that you can't trust the Bible because there's no such thing as a reptile that can spew fire out of its mouth. Those are the legends of dragons of old. Well, where do you think the legends of the dragons of old came from? Just because you and I don't see a creature today that could make some sort of a sound, a grunt or a snort or whatever, and produce fire, does that mean it never existed? Let me tell you something. In South Africa, we never had lightning bugs. That's not something that there was no beetle, nothing in South Africa that could produce light like that. So when I would tell my Zulu friends, hey, in America, we've got these little beetles. By the way, do you have them down here? Lightning bugs? You don't have them down here. Okay, but you all know what they are, right? Okay. So we didn't have them in South Africa. When I would tell them, oh, over in America, we've got little beetles that fly around, hundreds, thousands of them at night, and they have light. They can make real light. They laugh me out of the room. Oh, yeah, sure you got little beetles that can fly around making light. To them, it was 100% impossible, because they would ask me questions like, well, what happens when the light bulb burns out? How do they change the light? Or where does it plug in? Or where do the batteries go? And if the batteries get old, what happens? You see, they're thinking that it's like an incandescent light or whatever. And how could I describe to them, no, this is a, This is a chemical reaction. This is something I didn't know how to describe what was going on. And so to them, it was 100% impossible. Oh, yeah, Mike's telling us one of his silly stories again. Same thing in your part of the world. Have any of you ever actually found a bombardier beetle? They're found over from Texas, the whole way on over to here, even further west. Bombardier beetles are about the size of a lightning bug, but most people have never seen one. You find them in rotting vegetation and stuff like that. But a bombardier beetle is a little guy, and he's got a cannon at the back end. And that cannon can aim any direction he wants it to go. But when an enemy attacks him, he can fire it. But he's not firing a bullet. He's firing boiling water. It's 212 degrees. If you put your hand at the back of a bombardier beetle and disturb him so he fires his cannon, he'll fire it at you and you will get a blister. It's boiling water. Now, if you wouldn't see that with your own eyes, you wouldn't believe it. How does a beetle make boiling water and then not die himself? It's astounding how it works. When he eats food, he metabolizes these two different chemicals in one tank here and one tank here. When an enemy approaches, and all of this happens in an instant, just like that, he mixes a little bit of these chemicals, which immediately has a chemical reaction, and it gets very hot very quickly, but not quickly enough. So as soon as he mixes them, he injects a catalyst into it, which speeds up this chemical reaction. At that moment, the chemicals literally boil. It produces boiling, smelly, hot water. At that moment, the beetle has these powerful muscles that squeeze and blast the mixture out of its tube. All of that, the mixture, the catalyst, the explosion, everything, all of that happens in an instant. And what is amazing is when he blasts the cannon, you can actually hear a little pop, just like that. And you can actually, it looks like mist going up, almost like when you fire a gun, the smoke comes out. It looks the same. He'll fire his cannon. But each click where he fires the cannon, if you slow it way down, it's 15 bursts like a machine gun. But it is so rapid that it happens just in an instant of a second. If you look at our video called Face to Face with Leviathan, we're the only creation group that has a clip from National Geographic that actually shows it happening. And it was a miracle how we got the clip. I won't take time to tell you about it, but it's a miracle how we got the clip. And it actually shows it happening. You can see this thing wasting an ant that's right in front of it when it blasts the cannon. It's astounding how it works. If you wouldn't see that with your own eyes, you would never believe it's possible. Folks, it's the same thing with a Leviathan. Just because we don't know how he might have made fire come out does not mean the creature didn't used to be alive somehow. And so when somebody says, oh, that's just fairy tales, no, it isn't. This creature used to be alive, and in fact, maybe up until fairly recently. When I say fairly recently, maybe 400 years ago. Because China is called today the land of the dragon. And it could be the reason it's called that is because maybe that's where they were last seen. And can you imagine sitting in your house having supper and suddenly somebody comes to your door and goes, hey guys, come out here quickly. Look, two of those lizards are fighting in the river again. And so you run out there and you watch and you hear these snorts and you hear and you see the flame coming out. Wouldn't that make an impression on you? And boy, you'd probably include that in all of your festivals and everything. And that might be why China is called the land of the dragon to this day, because maybe that's where they were last seen. We don't know that. It's just an idea. So when somebody says, well, wait a minute, did these creatures really used to be alive? Folks, if you do a study, a real study of the real dragon, I'm not talking about the fairy tales of old, what they have you believing, in our fairy tales, the king says to the knights, go and kill the fierce dragon and chop off the head and bring it back and you get to marry the beautiful princess. And so the knight does that. He goes out and he chops off the head and he brings the head back and he marries the beautiful princess and they all live happily ever after. Isn't that a cute little fairy tale? And that's what the evolutionists think that we're believing. No, we believe if the Bible says there used to be a reptile that could breathe, spew fire out, it used to be alive. We don't know how it worked. We don't see any. We can't show how it worked, but they used to be alive. By the way, in your Bible and on mine, next to the word fire, there's a little asterisk, and at the bottom of the page it says, this is probably not fire, like you and I understand fire. This is probably the crocodile sticking out his tongue like a snake sticks out his tongue. Folks, they're talking to the wrong person. Remember, I grew up with crocodiles. They cannot even move their tongue like that, let alone stick it out of their mouth. No, this is real fire that's coming out of this creature. So again, just because you and I don't see one does not mean they didn't used to exist. So, as just by a way of, to bring this to a close, what kind of creature do you think you're looking at on a petroglyph on a rock here? What does that look like to you? Anyone want to hazard a guess? Yeah, right. It looks like a dinosaur. It looks like this guy, doesn't it? But yet it can't be, right? It can't possibly be. This is in Utah, and you guys don't live too far from these regions, so you'd probably be able to go up and see this. Have you ever been to Natural Bridges National Monument, just west, you know, near Hanksville, south of Hanksville? Well, go there. This is next to Kachina Bridge, and if you don't know exactly where to find it, you will never, ever, ever find it. We knew exactly where to look, and they're not. It's not this clear. This has been doctored a little bit so you can actually see it. You can actually see the petroglyph. You'd never know it's there, and that's the way the National Park wants it. They do not want you to know it's there because this is an anomaly. Why? Because if you've seen the petroglyphs that are all through your part of the world, and especially over in Arizona and up in Utah, there's thousands of petroglyphs around here. And as you probably all know already, they're creatures that you can see. There's lizards, there's bighorn sheep, there's moose, there's elk, there's hunting scenes, and you can see crabs, you can see, you know, snakes, you can see all kinds of things. These are things that the people are drawing on the rock, they're doing the stipplings on the rock, because they can see the creatures. So how come this thing would suddenly appear on a rock? Because a person had to have seen it to carve it on a rock. So when this was first discovered, again, the evolutionists had a cow over this. Oh no, this is just a stain on the rock. No. They had to back away from that because you can clearly see the rows of stipplings that make up the artwork, okay? So they had to back away from that. Then they claimed, oh no, it's a snake. Well, they had to back away from that because you can clearly see the legs. Now, here is what they have settled upon. Are you ready for this one? They've said, okay, here's probably what happened. Since in this part of the world, there's a lot of different solid, petrified dinosaur prints in rocks. So probably a Native American about 1,000 years ago, because they say it's about 1,000 years old, about 1,000 years ago, a Native American saw these footprints in the mud, footprints in the rock, and he probably thought, I wonder what that creature would have looked like. I think I'll climb up on this ledge and carve what I think the creature might have looked like. So sure, the footprints will tell you that it was a quadruped, it had 4 feet. Sure, the footprint is going to tell you that it had a long neck. Sure, the footprint is going to tell you that it had a long tail. So this is one of those things that they do not want you to know about. They don't want you to know it's in the park at all. But again, there it sits. And here's another one in the Grand Canyon. What does that look like to you? So anyway, dinosaurs have lived with people right from the beginning. It's exactly the opposite of what the evolutionists will tell you. So here, we'll put the basic pieces of the puzzle together. Dinosaurs were made on day number 6 with man. They lived with man for 1,656 years. That's the time frame in blue. They, with man, went on board the ark, and anyone who did not go on board the ark was killed in the flood. They came off of the ark, and they lived with man. They continued to live with man for a while, even though that's not important to the Bible to mention them. In fact, there are a couple times when creatures or large type of creatures like that are mentioned. And I forget the word they use, but they typically use the word dragon in the King James. Well, if you substitute the word dinosaur for dragon, then there are a couple times when dinosaurs might have been mentioned in the scripture throughout the Old Testament. In any event, the time frame in red that you're seeing there, that's the rest of the Old Testament. That's the time frame where the kings and the prophets lived. And finally, the Old Testament ends when the nation is coming back from captivity. That ends the Old Testament. Then the period between the end of the Old Testament and the New Testament is that period of 400 years there. The New Testament begins with the birth of someone. Who? Jesus. And he was about 2,000 years ago. So there you can add up everything for yourselves and you can see a much clearer, much more biblical answer to the issue of dinosaurs. It's not the mystery of the dinosaurs anymore. It's the history of the dinosaurs from the biblical perspective. Okay, so what we're going to do now is take however long a break you would like to have us take. And we come back, we'll do the last session called The Lost Secrets of the Ancient Civilizations, and we'll wrap up with that one. Thank you.